Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
When you're headed up 13th South and you reach the steepest part of the climb, just as you're about to crest the hill onto 13th East, you'll pass a building that used to be an assisted living center. These days, it's still a care facility, but a unique one. In fact, it's one of the only places of its kind in the country. It's called the In Between. It's one of those names that contains a pun, in spelled I-N-N, so it's a place to live for people who are homeless. But it also offers hospice services and medical recovery treatment, so it's for those in between life and death, or illness and health. The idea for the in-between first came to a nurse practitioner at the Huntsman Cancer Hospital. This was back in 2010. Her name is Debbie Thorpe.
I grew up as a child of a Methodist minister, so church and service was part of my DNA. And I always felt that being a nurse was my ministry. And the very beginning of the idea for the in-between came out of a discussion when I was working in the food pantry at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. I was in conversation with Meg Brady, who was also a professor up here at the U, and she wanted to know what we did when we had homeless people that required hospice care. My immediate response was, we'd tear our hair out, because it was terribly frustrating to try to find appropriate placement for people that were end of life but had no home. We'd make referrals to hospices, and their nurses would go to sometimes very treacherous places where people were either sleeping on the floor or couches in somebody's home or an abandoned trailer. They might be doing wound care. They would have aides come out and help with bathing, and many of them didn't have clothes or any place to bathe. So providing the basic necessities of daily living is a real challenge when you are in some place without any electricity or running water. And a lot of them would get lost. So we immediately began talking about what we could realistically do, and just reaching out to various people in the community, from churches, social workers, hospice companies, anybody. And our first idea was just to have a small house where we could house four or five people, maybe. And at this time, we were looking around for other models elsewhere in the United States, and we were quite surprised to find very few things that even came close to what we were trying to envision. I remember just going through real estate listings and looking at houses and driving by and looking, where is this? And sometime in, I think it was 2012, we heard about the Guadalupe School becoming available, and it had this convent attached to it. And we launched our first fundraiser so that we would be able to rent this property. And when you have a place that you can really do something, that's when things really began to coalesce. And we were able to get a lot of people interested as volunteers, and that to this day is really at the heart of the ability of the in-between to thrive, because we have so many dedicated volunteers that spend hours doing everything from cleaning to sitting with people as they die. My mother was a social worker, and so she modeled a lot of this kind of thing. In high school, when I lived in Kansas City, we did a mission from our church in the suburbs to a church in the inner city in Kansas City, and my mother worked at a storefront clinic in downtown Kansas City many, many years ago. it's just part of my DNA, I guess. It amazes me that we've gotten to this point and that we're serving as many people as we are now. And now to have, you know, approximately 50 beds available and that they're quite full most of the time. And we could probably double that and still find that there's not enough space to do it. And I feel very fulfilled, I think, maybe, that we were able to get through all those difficult years to get there. It just feels like it was what I was meant to do. And it's in those one-on-one relationships with the residents, which I miss. I'm not really very active right now in retirement, but I have a whole lot of wonderful memories of working with those people on a one-on-one basis and just the warm feeling in my heart that we were able to provide this for people.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this unique care facility, the In-Between. It's the latest subject of the filmmaker Andy Timoner. She documented a year in the lives of the residents there. We're going to be screening the film tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is part of our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll talk about the film in a moment, but first, to understand it, you'll want to know more about the In-Between. So we spoke with Jillian Olmsted. She's the executive director there. And she told us the best way to describe the In-Between is to call it home.
A place for individuals experiencing homelessness or at risk of experiencing homelessness to come and stay with us to either access professional hospice care and have that appropriate end-of-life care or receive medical respite, which could come in many forms. Someone needing major surgery needs an address before the surgery can happen. Someone needing intensive cancer treatment needs that bed, that address for someone to start that treatment plan with them. So I really like to say we try and be a home-like environment, but we're also providing so much more. But the basic part of our mission is that we're the place so that people can access the medical care that they need and that they deserve.
The film describes the In-Between as the only end-of-life facility of its kind in the U.S. But what makes it unique?
That's a really good question. So there's a few things that make us unique. There are small social model hospices. There's medical respites all over the United States. But we're one of the only that is a licensed medical facility. So we're an assisted living type 2. And then also our size is what makes us very unique. We're currently in the process of expanding from 50 to 80 beds. And then the fact that we have both end-of-life care and medical respite, as well as lots of wraparound services all under one roof, is what sets us apart from most of the other organizations in the United States.
So if you offer people in these conditions, medical care and community and, you know, love, I mean, even people that seem to be in terminal conditions, this could possibly change their terminal prognosis.
Yeah, and we see it not all the time, but we have about 28 cases where individuals have came in on hospice, anticipated to live less than 6 months, and having access to that professional hospice care, a roof over their head, 3 meals a day, like you just mentioned, love, they end up improving, no longer qualifying for hospice care. And then with anyone, hospice or not, we work with them for housing, making sure that all of their barriers to housing, whether that's just not simply not having your vital documents like your birth certificate or social security card. And so we're working with them from the time they come in so that once they recover hospice or recuperative care, hopefully they have options that isn't just continuing that cycle of homelessness.
What's the secret? Not that there's one secret sauce here, but there does seem to be, I don't know, if not a process, a kind of an idea. Is there a philosophy that's driving the In-Between?
Our core value of dignity is really what it all boils down to. We're treating people like we would want to be treated. And, you know, even though we work here and the volunteers that come in, we are in these individuals' homes and we make sure that they know it's their home and that they should respect it. And so should everyone else. And they should demand that. I think once you give someone that dignity and that respect, and they just think to themselves, maybe I'm actually worth this. Maybe I'm worthy of this care and this love. And I don't want to continue to be homeless, or I want to look into sobriety or change what I've been doing. And I just think when you give people that dignity and respect and make them feel like they belong somewhere, it really just starts to break down their walls that they've continually built up because they've been shut out from all sorts of things, right? Just even being on a street corner, they're kind of being shuffled around. So I think the dignity of respect and just a place where they belong.
Another one of those ideas at play here that I noticed in the film was that to create a sense of community and social connection, like that seems to be one of them. And one of the ways you go about that is this idea of self-governance. Talk a little bit about that part.
Yeah, I think that community would have probably been my, you know, next secret sauce ingredient. But yeah, we really found, I think, especially post-COVID, we were very short-staffed and our census was low too. But we just found that we were the ones policing the residents. We were the ones trying to solve all their problems and keep them happy. And once we really started utilizing a resident council, it helped them come together and funnel their complaints and their compliments and direct it to the staff in a much more appropriate way. And I think it causes them to take more ownership and realize that organizing and coming together as a community will help them get their needs met much better than, you know, being annoyed about maybe the grilled cheese wasn't melted enough or maybe their case manager was late to meet with them. They kind of realize those aren't the big issues. They want to talk about, you know, adding activities to the activities program, or how can they make sure everybody doesn't take too much coffee and there's enough for people who wake up late. So the residents vote whenever they need to replace a member. So there's president, vice president, and secretary. And then they are to work to, you know, recruit everyone to come to their once a week meetings, and they get together and they talk about just life at the in-between and what can they help contribute to and what do they need more support from the staff on.
You mentioned, I'm thinking this is another one of those principles or philosophies, and it seems to be the idea you mentioned before about you want it to feel like a home environment. And you've talked about the way the building itself is laid out, that you didn't intend for this because, you know, you moved into another kind of facility. But it turns out that the way it's designed has really worked out to provide that sense of community. It's this giant rectangle and it's hard to be isolated. Talk about just the design of the space that seems to work for you guys.
Yeah, seeing that on the film and talking to a few people afterwards asking us how do we create this community. And I really think the layout of our building is what contributes the most to this. We have a large centralized dining room that also gets turned into the place where we do arts and crafts, where we have bingo, music. We do our staff, resident, volunteer fun lunches where we all come together once a month and have a themed lunch together. Maybe we're dressing up, a variety of different things. So I think you can't really get away from those human interactions. And post-COVID, I think we all learned a lot from how that can affect your mental health if you're not having those just hello at the grocery store or, you know, bringing your neighbor something. It leads to increased mental health issues. You're more likely to get dementia, chronic illness, all sorts of things. So those human interactions where there's always a receptionist at the front desk to come and say hello to, volunteers constantly going throughout the building, chaplains, just people coming in and saying hello and having some of those human interactions, I think can help with healing more than we give it credit.
Hmm. How important is accountability, the idea of accountability?
It's really important. So even before residents come in and we're doing an assessment with them, we explain to them that we're a sober living environment and that we have house rules, we have bed checks every night, and that we, you know, we want you to respect this as if it's your home. And when they come in, we have a resident advocate. So someone who's been through our program, someone who lives here, meets with them, goes over all of the house rules and gives them a bit of an orientation. And, you know, we're not out to catch people who are relapsing, but we're here to support them. So, you know, if someone needs our help, we want them to feel comfortable to come and talk to us and know that, you know, we're not going to kick them out of our facility. We're going to hold their bed. We're going to offer them a detox stay. We're going to offer to help get them into whatever treatment program they need to get into, and that they can always come back to us. There is no, you slip up and you're not going to be here anymore. But, you know, any sort of physical violence, dealing of drugs, there's some infractions that we don't really give second chances for, and especially if it's affecting the safety and well-being of the other residents here.
Jillian Olmsted, she's the executive director and the CEO of The In Between, which is the subject of the latest film in our film series. It's called The In-Between, and we're going to be screening it tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll get started at 7. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a unique care facility in Salt Lake City that offers hospice services and medical recovery treatment for people experiencing homelessness. It's called The In-Between. And it's that mix of assistance for those who are dying and for those who might recover that makes it one of the only places of its kind in the country. Tonight, we're going to be screening a documentary about The In-Between by the filmmaker Andy Timoner. She spent a year recording the lives of the residents there. We'll hear from Andy in a moment, but we have with us Jillian Olmsted. She's the executive director of The In-Between.
So the filmmaker, Andy Timoner, she told us that when you change, I'm trying to think how to put this, she said, when you change the context that people see of these, the people that are in the in-between, or the context of their lives, in other words, from the background that people normally see, you know, they see them at a temporary shelter wandering around, or they see them just in the street. When you change that context to a home, which you see here in the film, that it changes how people look and think of them. Will you talk a little bit about that and how something like this, I guess, transforms, maybe that's too dramatic, but changes the way people think about people who are homeless?
It's very interesting to me that if you see in the newspaper, even if that's someone who's currently staying at the in-between, but say a photo was snapped of them on the street corner, they can very easily be seen as a nuisance, where if you see them in the in-between and they're, you know, sweeping or, you know, helping another resident in their wheelchair, it just changes what we think of people. And unfortunately, that's all of our, you know, preconceived notions and all of the, you know, normally what you're hearing about in the news when it comes to unsheltered individuals is a very, very small number of individuals with significant untreated mental health. Or, of course, there's going to be individuals that are just making bad choices. But the majority of these individuals were just like you and I. They had a job. They got a medical diagnosis that caused them to not be able to go to work. So they lost their job. They lost their insurance. And then next comes the eviction. And so to make them into horrible people and not help them is, I think, what's really hard is that we just put everyone in the category that because you're homeless, you're now no longer a good person, or you're now, you know, a stain on society. So I think it's interesting to me when people come and tour the in-between, and we get a lot of those same statements like, oh, wow, everyone here is well-kept or dressed nicely or doesn't smell, all these things. Well, those are all byproducts of not having access to the appropriate resources, and it's not the choice of these individuals. So I agree. I think it's a really great thing that Andy picked up on is you put them in a home-like environment and it just really changes how you think about all these individuals and what you want to do to help them.
Well, this gets us to what I wanted to ask you about, the reaction that you got from the neighbors when you announced you were going to open the in-between. This comes up in the film. Talk a little bit about the initial reaction and talk about how it, I mean, people were thinking, and this happens all the time, and I'm guessing you're probably, I don't know if you've encountered it now that you've decided you're going to go from, what did you say, 60 to 80, 50 to 80 beds. I'm not sure if you'll encounter the same thing or if you're anticipating it, but there is an initial kind of suspicion among neighbors. This sort of NIMBY reaction comes up in the film. Talk about the initial reaction and what happens there.
Yeah, so really the initial reaction when we were opening on the West Side is the reason why I got involved. I was seeing articles in the newspaper about how upset the neighborhood was that we were going to house homeless, dying people in a neighborhood where people existed, right? They wanted this to be in an industrial area away from people. And I had never experienced hospice care until that time. Both my mom and stepdad were diagnosed within a few weeks of each other. A year later, they died a few weeks apart from each other on hospice. And it just made me realize how amazing hospice was. My stepdad was an old cowboy from North Dakota, hated the hospital, but was self-discharging constantly. And so for them to come in and put in a chairlift and grips in the shower and make it so that he could stay in his home and have that dignity, it just made me wonder, why do we feel like those that don't even have a home to begin with don't at least deserve this while they're dying? So that's what initially got me involved with volunteering, is I wanted to make sure I supported something that I knew everyone deserved access to. And I think once we kind of worked through things with the neighbors in our initial building, we found this new facility to move into and we started to experience the exact same thing. However, I would say maybe they were a little bit better at organizing. There were a few individuals who started a GoFundMe to raise money to get an attorney to try and prevent us from staying here. We had a few people who we had to trespass from our property because they were coming in, not signing in, just walking in to our building. And despite us trying to provide a place for them to communicate with us, we had monthly neighborhood council meetings. So we would allow the neighbors to come in and speak with staff members. And it constantly turned into arguments. So we decided to stop those because it was stressful, I think, for everyone involved, including the residents. We just really felt like it was a lot of negativity to bring into their space. Everyone was starting to feel unwanted, whether or not you were a staff member or a resident of the in-between. And so we just made a place where people could submit their comments via email. And that is when a lot of it stopped. I think part of it was just the ability to come and be heard and have their fears of the unknown be heard. And we all know that's the thing. If you've never experienced a facility like this in your neighborhood, your imagination might run wild about what could happen. But over the years, we just started working really closely with those neighbors that were kind of on the fence about us, asking them, what are your concerns? What are your fears? We tried to really make friends with them, invite them in, recommend that they maybe volunteer with us, spend some time here. And then I think the biggest thing was just time. There has not been a single situation where the neighbors have had to, you know, call 911 because a resident was doing something, you know. It hasn't happened. So I think we're at 6 years in this new facility. And if you walk around the neighborhood, you might still even see some of the yard signs that say, we love the in-between, which were made by the group of neighbors that very much welcomed us into their space. But the neighborhood upset did prevent us from changing the zoning language early on. We wanted to be able to use the building to its full capacity right away. And in hindsight, it was probably better because going from 16 beds to 50 beds was already quite the task.
Better to ease into it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it allowed us to figure out how to run an assisted living facility, follow all of the regulations, find the funding to back all of it. And now we might get a call that the water from our roof is running down the sidewalk. We need to fix our gutter. Or sometimes residents just smoking out on the sidewalk bother some of the neighbors. And again, we can't prevent people from smoking on the sidewalk, but we can talk to the residents and ask them to, you know, make sure if someone's walking by to move out of their way. But, you know, those are conversations that are much easier for me to take compared to the prior complaints of why are you in our neighborhood and, you know, you need to take these people someplace else.
Jillian, what have you learned about dying since you've been at the in-between? I mean, this is I guess it is a theme in the film. We meet Kimberly, of course. She's a death doula there. And the question comes up, you know, like what happens? This is asked in the film. What happens to people when they're actively dying and they don't have a home? And, you know, that's an added dimension here. But set that aside for a second. Just tell me, what have you learned, if you have anything? And I'm hope not to put you on the spot here, but what have you learned about dying?
That's a really good question. I think I go between, you know, the matter-of-fact answer and maybe some really big existential type answer. But I think one of the biggest things I've learned is when people have lots of unsettled business and maybe have had tumultuous lives, their passings can be equally as tumultuous. And there's a lot to be said about having an end-of-life doula, having chaplains, having all of our great No One Dies Alone volunteers to come and sit bedside and talk with people and allow people who are dying to just work through everything that's, you know, kind of just racing through their minds as they come to grips with the fact that they're actually dying. And like I mentioned, they're young.
Yeah.
They likely have had mental health issues or substance use disorder, which has caused them to be estranged from their family. And as we know, most people don't understand those conditions. And it's sometimes easier to push those people out of your life than try and help them and understand it all. So I think the biggest thing for me is it looks so different for so many people. And I really do think that having caring, compassionate humans that are there for people at the end of life to tell them it's okay. It's okay that, you know, things weren't perfect. It's okay that you maybe did bad things, but you need to let yourself be okay with it so that you can pass peacefully and not, you know, go through a struggle, because sometimes it can be long and it seems extremely painful. Again, I don't know what all they're going through, but yeah, I think it's really important to give people that space in hopes that they can leave this world in a peaceful way.
There's this really interesting moment in the film. It involves Patty Larson, who had stage 4 lung cancer. And she's one of those people who was able to leave the in-between because of the care, the community that was offered. So she's able to leave. And when she leaves, she says this thing. She says that she still dreams she's homeless. And there's something almost sad in the fact that Patty isn't at the in-between anymore, even though you would see that as a success, but only for the reason that she was now disconnected from that community that she'd been a part of. What do you make of that sort of moment? Because it does speak to the importance of community. It does speak to the tragedy of isolation.
Yeah, when people are with us for a long time, like Patty was, which is relatively uncommon, but as you saw in the video, she had a plethora of comorbidities that she was dealing with, and it's a miracle that she was able to work her way through all of those things, considering she was chronically homeless for, I think it was almost 20 years. And so for her to just even be able to exist in a room with 4 walls and have that not make her go crazy was just one hurdle that we had to get over. But yeah, it is really hard. It's hard to say goodbye. And I wish that there was another in-between. So what is the in-between for people when they feel they can go into housing, but maybe they really do need a lot more support? And I think those are all types of organizations that Salt Lake and other cities are trying to find, because we're seeing that traditional shelters are more of a one-size-fits-all and can lead to that isolation. Or if people go into housing and they're just all of a sudden alone, do they even know how to keep their housing if they've never had a house or have been chronically homeless? So it is hard. It's like watching one of your kids go off to college and you wonder if they even know basic math yet, you know?
Let me ask you finally, why aren't the principles of the in-between, the notions of self-governance and community and accountability and, you know, all of the things that you were talking about, why isn't that being put into place in, you know, like all over the place?
That's another really big question. I think so much of it boils down to the Band-Aid effect that we've had, especially as the homeless population has exploded all over the place. It's all of the homeless resources are typically underfunded, understaffed, and they're just trying to get the basic needs met. And I think it takes a lot to get to the space. And I feel very lucky that this all came to fruition in Utah, because I think Utah is a very giving state. We're very fiscally responsible, so not necessarily throwing money at lots of problems, but volunteerism is, you know, top in the nation, and individual giving is really great, and we have lots of great foundations. So I think part of it is just where you are and how well it's accepted. And then I think the other big thing is, if there's not an ability to bill insurance or have some sort of sustainable funding for a program like this, it's pretty scary to start it. Because what are you going to do if you get this really great program going that has all the bells and whistles like the in-between has, and then there's no sustainable funding, and funders start saying, hey, you know, you're 3, 4, 5 years old, you should be sustainable now, we're not going to fund you. And that happens all the time, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We're hopefully really close to being able to bill insurance, but only a handful of states have passed a Medicaid waiver that allows organizations to bill for medical respite for homeless. And I think if, as a country, as a state, as a community, we start funding more dignified care, it will happen. But it almost always boils down to funding and capacity.
Well, Jillian Olmstead, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Jillian Olmstead. She's the executive director and CEO of The In Between. Tonight, we're going to be screening filmmaker Ande Timoner's documentary, also called The In Between. We'll be at the City Library at 7. For more details, you can visit our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about The In-Between. It's a hospice and medical care facility for people experiencing homelessness. And as you heard, its beginnings and its mission make it, for some reason, unique in the U.S. Ande Timoner made a film about The In-Between, which we're going to be screening tonight at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City. The film was produced and scored by Morgan Doctor. You'll also hear from her in this conversation. Over the years, Timoner has tackled a wide range of projects, a documentary on controversial comedian Russell Brand, a feature about the artist Robert Mapplethorpe, and a deeply personal story about her father's decision to end his life due to chronic pain. But the idea for this one came from her mom.
Mom lies on the couch and spends a lot of time with the newspaper every day. And so when she sees anything that she thinks I should know about, she gets out her clippers and she clips it out. And she clipped out this article that the LA Times had about the in between. And it was called the in between, like INN between, like an in between what? I didn't know, but the headline was compelling. And finally, I got around to reading it. I was on tour with Last Light Home. You know, that is about the last weeks of my father's life. And so it's about death. And it's also about all of the life and love and presence and wisdom that is immediately around one when one is experiencing the passing of someone they love. I was primed, right?
Yeah.
And so reading this article about this amazing place that if it really exists, we have to make a short film about it, at least to support the model and to make sure it keeps going, because this sounds incredible. So we decided, okay, on the way to Sundance, and this is a few years ago, mm-hmm. we'll stop in. We'll ask them if we can come in with cameras. We told them who we are. So they let us in with cameras. And we decided if we see cats and dogs on the premises and they have pets running around, and it feels cozy, we should do this. So we went in, and the first thing we see is Boo Boo the dog, like cross-eyed, you know, severely overweight, obese, like mutt. And then there's this cat named Rogers that we meet soon thereafter, who rides curled around the neck of the resident death doula. And the resident death doula, Kimberly, was a resident there, we come to find, and she's helped something like over 30 people now transition and die. And former Congressman Ben McAdams visits the inn while we're there during the course of the filming. And he says, it's that they know that if they're going to die, people actually care, like that there's actually, it matters that their life mattered to someone, you know,
yeah.
There's so many levels of why this is like compassionate and should exist in every city in America. And so we just decided that this would be our way of giving back, is to spend a year inside there and make this film.
I want to get at something I think the film really explores just through the stories, the visuals. And that is, what is it about the in between that's unique or different? Like, what's the secret? What is it about? And one of the things that comes up in the film is it's creates a community and not just a sense of people who have, they're in similar circumstances, but there's a kind of framework. There is a community council. There's a kind of hierarchy in some ways. You vote. Talk a little bit about the idea of community, because that seems like if there's a secret sauce to the in-between, this may be one of them. So talk about that, and also introduce us to Patty, because Patty's connection to community is a really important one.
Yeah. So Patty, one of our main characters, who came into the in-between with 6 weeks to live because she had stage 4 lung cancer. And we meet her 2 years later, and she's gone into remission. And she's one of a few stories of people that have recovered after coming into this facility. And part of that is because the stress of being homeless is not with them anymore. She said to us privately, you know, I haven't been able to lock a door for 12 years. And I think having just that kind of ability to relax and get the actual care that you need. So Patty was the president of the resident council. And at the end of the film, she, I don't want to give it away, but she does move out into her own living situation, and she comes back and talks to the residents there. And what she says is so important. She's like, it's not for, there is no staff there. It's for you guys, you know, and there's things in place that allow people there to be empowered and to feel like they have purpose in their life. And the other one is Amos applying to be on the staff there. And so they allow them opportunities to have jobs before they leave and get trained, and then so they can move forward with their lives. And so I think it's both. I think it's like this element of being able to feel like you're part of a community, but you have what you say is important in that community.
Morgan brought up Amos, and he's someone who keeps to himself, who has been through a lot, who's been to prison, who's open about that on camera in the film. But he comes to feel so embraced by this place and speaks so intelligently with former Congressman Ben McAdams about the recidivism rate and how the system as is just would send someone back to prison right away. But for him, it's been so helpful. Well, it's exactly that. It's the community aspect. It's him feeling like not only is he being served by being there, like, you know, in that his medical team can come and see him there, etc. He gets three meals a day and a door to close and safety, but he actually can give back. He has a role to play within the community. And that's essential to who we are as human beings. So Patty, you know, same thing. She came to be a role model for people there. She had been there for so long. She came in so angry. She came in on death's door and she fully recovered, you know, and even went off palliative care, didn't need anything, I think, because she was so embraced there and she felt like she could help other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychologist who survived the Holocaust, observed that we as human beings need to have meaning in our lives in order to find happiness. Happiness does not come from having our desires fulfilled or our unconscious desires fulfilled. It comes from one of three ways: work, love, or suffering. And so many of the people that come into this facility, they don't have any of the three. You know, well, they have suffering. They have suffering, but they don't have work and they don't have love. And a lot of times they can't make any meaning out of their suffering because it's so haphazard day to day. So they come into this place, and even though they might be suffering physically still, and all of them are, you know, they find joy and happiness for the first time because they find a place inside a community.
Yeah. I think for people listening right now, they probably may remember when the In-Between opened in 2014, and there was a dispute, a question about whether or not the residents of that area would want something like this here. And there was that, you know, sort of NIMBY argument that played out, and you reference it in the film. Talk a little bit about that initial sense of skepticism from the neighborhood, that initial resistance, but how, as you've talked about, it kind of gives way to something else.
Yeah, so part of the film is this like massive resistance to people having low-income housing or even, yeah, these kind of halfway homes for people in their neighborhood. But it's like, well, you're going to seriously be threatened by some people that are in hospice and they're all in wheelchairs. Like, no one's going to go and, you know, break into your house where they are in their lives right now. So it was kind of, I think once that place was there and settled in, and yeah, and a lot of the neighbors now donate their time. They drop groceries off.
They teach jewelry making classes. They love that the In-Between is there. Yeah. Like, it's like the opposite of NIMBY. It's like NIMBY flipped on its head.
Yeah.
But it was this fear of like, oh no, they're going to break into our houses. Like, no, they're in a wheelchair or they're struggling to live. Like, they've had an operation and they, you know, like, they're not coming to your house.
Yeah. We should mention that you lost your home and everything you had. This was in Altadena, of course, in that recent fire, those fires in California. And I think a lot of people would say that, as you yourself would say, you know, there's a lot different in our circumstance than the people who are in the In-Between, of course. But as far as about the part of losing everything you have or your home, how are you both relating to this part? Was the experience, that experience of losing everything, did you connect differently with the people that you had already met in the In-Between? Did you relate in a certain way that was, I mean, obviously?
It was really interesting, you know, because it's a month ago today, we were in Rome heading to Budapest filming a film about the Holocaust. And I had an interview with a Holocaust survivor the morning after we found out the house burned down. I did the interview and it gave me perspective. And he said to me, I'm so sorry for the loss of your house. And I said, oh, please, it's nothing compared to what you've been through in your life. And he said, no, it's actually a lot. And of course, I was in shock then, and it has hit me in waves, and I'm grieving like everyone else of the 50,000 homeless people that were not homeless a month ago. And it is just proof that this can happen in an instant, you know? And it does make me, it doesn't make me any more aligned with or closer with my subjects. My subjects, our subjects from this film, like, we're in touch with them all the time. We love them and we feel like they're our friends, you know? Yeah. Like, I text with Kimberly on a regular basis.
Wow.
But I also felt like it's very ironic and very poetic and very much on point with the point. One of the points that The In-Between makes is how this can happen overnight. And it did literally happen to us overnight and so many of our friends. And if I didn't have the support system and the community of the documentary filmmaking world, of the Academy, and I was like, you know, I'm so lucky to have this community going into this. Most people who are in The In-Between, they don't have the community going into it. They have the community once they get to The In-Between. And it's the community that is so soul sustaining. You know, it's the community that has kept us standing.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point, back to the point of the film.
It makes me think, Andy, of a scene in the film. Morgan mentioned, we don't need to say too much about it or give too much away, but Patty, that we were talking about a moment ago, she transitions out. And we see her outside of The In-Between in her own place. And I think it's going to raise a question. It certainly did for me. It's going to raise a question for some viewers of it about whether it's better for her to be there than on her own, because she was on the resident council. She was part of a community. She was, not that she couldn't have a life outside, of course, but it did really underscore the value of a community, seeing her apart from it. How are you thinking about that scene, which almost seems sad or disappointing, even though it was a moment of triumph for Patty in some way?
I mean, I think that's why I have that montage of her lying in her bed with the surveillance camera.
Yeah.
Because you see that she's alone and isolated. And I don't really want to go into what's happened with Patty on this show, but it has taken its toll. Hmm. She really needs to be in community, you know? And it's very important that, you know, that's why this is such a huge issue. And it's very difficult, I think, for people to wrap their heads around how to help homelessness, because they need community more than just while they're dying.
Yeah.
We all need community. We're social animals. We don't exist in a vacuum. And it's very hard after 20 years on the street and then a few years in a place where there's the same people that you get to see and they become family and everybody asks you how you're doing every day, to then be alone again. So it's been really sad to kind of watch what's happened with Patty since she left The In-Between. But we're all trying. We're all trying to get her back to The In-Between. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Let me ask you finally. Andy, you said this in an interview. You said that when you would go to do the filming at The In-Between, you never wanted to leave. What do you mean? Say something about that and your relationship with those people there, finally.
Yeah. So when I would be there, you know, as Monty, the founder, one of the founders pointed out, you know, it's built sort of in a circle. So you go left or you go right and you end up back in the lobby again, you know, and it goes all the way around all the rooms. And so we would literally find ourselves just running around and ending up in conversations or in people's rooms or in the lunch hall or wherever. And we didn't want to leave because it was so cozy. These stories and the people that you meet, they're just so wonderful. We just wanted to stay. And so suddenly we'd be there way past when we were planning to be there, you know? But it was blessed. You know, it's a really blessed experience. And we're just so honored that we were allowed in, and we feel so blessed to have been able to make the friends we made there and to be able to tell this story. And we just hope it makes a difference in the world.
Well, thank you both very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Doug.
Andy Timoner. She directed the documentary film The In-Between. Morgan Doctor also joined us. She produced and scored the film. They're going to be joining us tonight via Zoom after our screening. This is at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll get started at 7. You can get more details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.